We apologize for the poor quality of this recording. Due to some computer errors, we were not able to use our regular equipment, but we wanted to make sure that you were able to hear this important sermon.
Our scripture lesson this morning is taken from Matthew chapter 7, verses 21 through 28. Would you please stand? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father in heaven. On that day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do many deeds of power in your name? Then I will declare to them, I never knew you. Go away from me, you evildoers. Everyone then who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on rock. The rain fell, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall because it had been founded on rock. And everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. Now when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were astounded at his teaching. This is the word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks for seeing it. Just a word before we begin this morning. We are finishing our series on the Sermon on the Mount today, and as I said, next week is Advent, and we're starting a new sermon series then. And, you know, it's always interesting when you're a preacher and you come to this next season of Christmas and Advent, because everybody is very familiar with all the texts, right? We know all those familiar stories from old times, and so it's always a challenge every year to go back and look at that. So Joe and I were kind of looking at this over the course of the last few weeks, and one of the things that struck me as I was looking at Luke chapters 1 and 2 again, is that there are actually four songs in there. There's the song of Mary, the song of Zechariah, the song of the angels, which we're most familiar with on Christmas Eve, and there's also the song of Simeon, who was the old man present when Jesus was dedicated in the temple. And I got to thinking about the fact that those four songs are really the first Christmas carols. And so our sermon series starting next week is the first carols. We're going to look at each one of those in turn. And I think some of you will be glad for that, because one of the things that happens during Advent, and this is always really intentional for us preachers, is that everybody wants to sing Christmas carols at Advent. And that's not right, liturgically speaking. To not sing Christmas carols during Advent. You know, when you're in church, you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't do that because it's not Christmas yet. We can't sing about the newborn king a month before it happens. Except for the fact that everywhere else in the culture, Christmas carols are sung in August at Walmart and in other places. So, those of us who are liturgical snobs have to make concessions at times. And so we will be singing some Christmas carols during Advent. And all will be well with everyone. It's going to be great times for the story. Thank you for all of you. Even though I'm not real thrilled about it. So anyway, we'll go there. So I hope you want to be part of that. That's, today we come to this last sermon in this series of the Sermon on the Mount. And this has been a series that Joe and I have talked about quite a bit and said that this has been a little profound for us. And I hope it's been profound for you too, going through these important texts. And it brought up some stories to mind, too, as I was going through it. Back in 2006, I had the opportunity to go on a spiritual pilgrimage to the Isle of Iona in Scotland. Now, if you know anything about the Highlands of Scotland, there are little islands on the west coast of Scotland called the Hebrides. And out there, there are some tiny little islands. And Iona is the farthest you can go west before you hit the North Sea and you go off to Ireland. Now, I've been to Scotland once before. When I was a junior in high school, I had a chance to go on a mission trip to Scotland over the course of the summer between my junior and senior year. My church sponsored me to go with Team Mission International, and I went over there. We did street evangelism in Glasgow, Scotland for 6 weeks. And I've always been fascinated with Scotland. That's why I wanted to go there. I'm adopted, so I'm not sure exactly what my ethnic heritage is. Although a couple years ago, the agency contacted my birth mother, and she told them a little bit of information. One of the things she told them, though, was that my background at least has some Scots-Irish in it, which makes sense because Western Pennsylvania is full of Scots-Irish people. It's a very Presbyterian area. That's because when the Scots and Irish migrated to America because of the potato famine in the 18th century, there was no place respectable for them to live in the colonies, so they sent them all out to the woods in Western Pennsylvania, and that's where my people were from. So I've always had that, but I always knew in my deepest heart of hearts that I was Scottish because for one main reason. One, because every time bagpipes play, the hair stands up at the back of my neck, and I want to go attack something. You know, that's the heritage that I have. So I was really excited. I was going over to the UK for a Wesley study tour, so I arranged to go a little early to go to Iona. Now, Iona is only 3 miles long and a mile and a half wide. And it was here that in the 6th century, Christianity first came to Scotland. The story goes that there was a monk in Ireland named Columba. And Columba had gotten into a conflict with some other monks, which started a war. And the war was over, get this, the copying of some scriptures. Who should copy them, how they should be copied. So there was a war, lots of people got killed. This is a very Christian way of handling things. There was a war, a bunch of people got killed, and Columba realized he had caused it all. So he left Ireland in disgrace. He took some of his monks with him, left Ireland in disgrace, and he promised God, the first piece of land that I come to that's out of sight of Ireland, I will establish a monastery there, and I will bring Christianity to the Picts, who are the original Scottish people. So this is where Columba landed, on Iona, this tiny little place. Now, even today, Iona is not an easy place to get to. When I went, I landed in Edinburgh, spent the day touring Edinburgh. The next morning, got up, took the train to Glasgow, an hour, and then from Glasgow, took a train 3 hours north to the little port city of Oban. In Oban, I got on a ferry that took me 45 minutes through these islands over to the Isle of Mull. On the Isle of Mull, I got off the ferry and got on a bus, and the bus went an hour and a half across the Isle of Mull on a one-lane road, where you had to stop occasionally to let other cars pass, but most often you had to stop to let the sheep cross, because there aren't that many people on Mull, just a bunch of sheep in the middle of nowhere. So an hour and a half across Mull on this one-lane road, and you get to another tiny little village called Finnefort. And at Finnefort, you get off the bus, and you get onto another ferry that takes you a mile across the channel to Iona. You have to want to get there if you want to be there. And because of that, it's a very quiet place. And a lot of people have believed from the earliest centuries that Iona had sort of a mystical quality to it. The Celts call it a thin place. And in Celtic terminology, that means a place where the veil between heaven and earth is quite thin. It's a very mystical and special place. And there's a little abbey there, a 12th century abbey, where the ecumenical Iona community worships twice a day. Some small homes there in the village. About 100 people live there year-round. And so I stayed in this lovely little guest house and planned my 3 days of solitude in this mystical, thin place. Well, I got there in the evening, because it took all day to get there with all that planes, trains, and automobiles. And I got to the island, stopped at the guest house, bunked in for the night, got up the next morning at breakfast, and I asked my hostess, where are some great places on the island to hike to? And she gave me some ideas, some places to go see on the backside of the island. And then after she said all that, she told me something I thought was strange. She said to me with a very serious look on her face, "Don't get lost." And I said, "Okay, I'm a trained infantry scout, trained in navigation, trained in terrain recognition. I have an inner sense of direction, very good. And I'm on an island that's only 3 miles long and a mile and a half wide. I figure if I hit water, I went too far." So I just wanted to start hiking. And I have my rain jacket on, because you never know it's going to rain in Scotland. But I, you know, just have a rain jacket on, some jeans, a hat. And I'm going out there to have a special communion with God. And I did that. I started to walk across. I left the main road, and I started walking across the green fields on the back part of the island, where there's a golf course. It's a free golf course. It's one of the original Scottish golf courses. Free. The only way you know there's a golf course there was by the stone markers that represent tee boxes and the fact that there are flags everywhere. Otherwise, you would have no idea because the sheep are everywhere. The way they keep the grass mowed is with the sheep. So if you're going to play golf, which I didn't get a chance to do, you have to play around the sheep. There, chipping has a whole different experience. So I went through this green area, and I went up over the rocks and this little hill. There's no trees there, so I went over these little rocks and hill back to the backside of the island at Columbus Bay, where tradition says Columbus was landed for the first time. And I'm there walking on this beach, this rocky beach, and I'm having this marvelous time of prayer and reflection. And so forth. I'm out there just kind of wandering around. I'm really watching where I'm going. And all of a sudden, it starts to rain. Now, you and I have both been in rain before, right? You know what rain is like. I have never seen rain, however, go horizontal and sometimes vertical. It rained so hard, so fast, and there was no warning whatsoever that it was coming. Bam, it started to pour. I had this high tech rain jacket on. It took 30 seconds for that to be an utter fail. My jeans almost became soaked. My shoes were filling with water. The rain was so hard that you could not lift your head to look up because it was pelting you in the face. Intensive rain. And I thought to myself, okay, here I am on an island 3 miles long and a mile and a half wide, and I am going to die of hypothermia. A mile from where I should be. This is crazy. So I started to think, what's the quickest way back? Because I was really into trouble. I was shivering the whole deal. How do I get back now? The quickest way back to the guest house. So I'm looking around the beach, and suddenly I come across a Karen. Now, you know what a Karen is. We see them a lot here in Colorado. They're used to mark the trail when there are no trees. Now, I grew up hiking in western Pennsylvania, where there are blazes on all the trees, on the Appalachian Trail and other places, but here, it's all cairns. And there was a little cairn there off the beach that was next to a tiny little path that went up the hill through the rocks and back out onto the golf course. I found my way back. When I cut back to the guest house, though, I walked in. After all, my shoes had been sucked off several times while I was trying to walk because there are peat bogs everywhere. So I'd lost my shoes several times. So they're covered in mud. And I walk back to the guest house, and I look at the woman. She just looks at me with one of those looks, you know. Typical Scottish look. You got lost, didn't you? Yes, I did. She made me some tea and tried to suppress her laughter. It was a powerful experience, though, to think that that little Karen helped me find the way in the midst of a place that I thought, well, I was sure I knew the way. And I didn't. I needed to find a way back home. Well, this experience got me thinking. And as I was preparing this sermon, this story came back to me. Because back where we started with the Sermon on the Mount, you might remember when we talked about the idea that Jesus is giving us marker points along the way. Marker points on the pathway of discipleship. And sometimes we think of discipleship as kind of something murky out there. We're not sure where it is. It's sort of like taking a path into the fog in some sense. What does it look like? Where does it take us? How do we get there? We're not sure exactly. Well, when we read the Sermon on the Mount, we get the idea that Jesus is taking us someplace very important. Indeed, I would argue that he's taking us to a thin place. Remember Matthew 4:17, which is really the first sermon that Jesus gives in the Gospel of Matthew. When he preaches one sentence, which like a one-sentence sermon, hit the high note, walk off the stage, he gives that first sermon. He says this, repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come near. Now remember the idea of the kingdom. It's the thin place. It's the reality where heaven and earth come together. It's the journey to this kingdom, this thin place, on which Jesus invites his disciples to live and to work, to do God's will on earth as it is in heaven, until such time as they come together forever. Jesus wants us thus to be at home in both places now, so that when they come, it won't be such a culture shock. So Jesus takes his disciples then up on the mountain. He gives them these markers for this journey to a thin place of discipleship. Spiritual cairns that Jesus has placed before them by embodying the life of the kingdom right in front of them. So he lays out this pathway, which we have called a rule of life, that will guide them in the midst of this misty and murky and muddled world where the path can be easily lost if you're not paying attention. Remember some of the markers we've already seen. We started with those 9 Beatitudes that mark the character of a disciple, a character of humility and single-mindedness and peacemaking. Disciples are not to charge off into the world confident in their own abilities, but to submit themselves to the direction of God through obedience and submission, even in the midst of persecution and trial. The blessed, you'll recall, are those who listen to Jesus and mind the markers of his character. We then moved into another section of markers where Jesus laid a new foundation over a much older path. Remember that Jesus said, I did not come to abolish the law of the prophets, the law of Moses, but I came to fulfill. He thus gives his disciples a series of ways that they're fulfilled, and he embodies these in his own person. And he does this by giving that contrasting sign. Remember that thesis, antithesis? You have heard that it was said, but I say to you. The disciples' path isn't simply marked by what they don't do, but by what they do that reflects the character of Jesus. Things like replacing anger and judgment with reconciliation, replacing lust and adultery with commitment and respect, replacing oaths with actions, replacing retaliation with love for one's enemies, and replacing performance with perfection. But Jesus then recognizes that there are some markers that, while they look like they can lead in the right direction, can actually lead down the wrong path. And so, as we started a couple weeks ago, he gives us 9 markers of failure that reveal the difference between performance and perfection. We don't give or pray or fast, Jesus says, so that we can impress others with our piety. Instead, we are to give and pray and fast in secret, seeking to please God more than others. We mustn't store up treasure on earth for ourselves or turn our vision towards shiny material things, serving wealth as our master, nor should we worry about what we lack. Instead, the pathway of the disciple is the way of trusting God to supply all of our needs while we invest our lives in people, making disciples who will make more disciples, thus changing the world to look more like the kingdom one life at a time. In chapter 7, then, Jesus names the last 2 of these markers. We already mentioned one of them when we talked about anger, but in 7:1-5, Jesus talks about judgment, that we don't take God's job of ultimate judgment on others. Instead, we pay attention to our own weaknesses. We don't go trying to pick specks out of other people's eyes. We worry about the log that's in our own. Next, Jesus says we don't take that which was sacred and throw it away. That includes ourselves. We keep what God has said is holy. Holy. Remember that when God created us, he called us to be people created in the image of God. That's what it means to be holy, to be full, to be complete. He says, don't throw that away. Don't throw it away in front of other things and other people. We'll tell you otherwise. Instead, we take up the role of life that keeps our focus on the pathway of serving God and serving others. And in chapter 7, verses 7-11, Jesus tells his disciples to turn to God and ask for what they need. Ask, seek, knock. And then in verse 12, he turns their attention to others by stating a rule of life that sums up the law and the prophets. You know this one, the golden rule. Do to others as you would have them do to you. That's the way of perfection. So this pathway of discipleship that Jesus lays out for his disciples is not an easy one, and he's quick to admit that. The sermon closes with 4 more signs, 4 more cairns, if you will, that warn us who would take this journey, that sticking to the path he has laid out is the only way to life. Look at verse 13. Jesus says, enter through the narrow gate, for the gate is wide and the road is easy that leads to destruction. And there are many who take it, for the gate is narrow and the road is hard that leads to life. And there are few who find it. If we've been paying attention, we might recognize that Jesus has actually been saying this all along through the sermon. This way of life, this way of the kingdom, isn't easy. Later, he will tell his disciples that this is the way of the cross. It requires you to give up a claim on your life, to love those who hate you, to let loose of the assumed security of money and possessions, to forgive as you are forgiven. Few people take this path, even those who claim to be followers of Christ. It's very interesting that it's come to be known in many churches that there's a difference between being a Christian and being a disciple, right? A Christian is someone who comes to church, you know, does Christian-type things, acts in a Christian way. We're part of a Christian nation, the assumption goes, right? But if you really want to be a disciple, well, that's a whole other level. That's the radical level. That's for the real serious people to be a disciple. But you know, Jesus never makes the distinction. He never calls people Christians, by the way. He only calls them disciples. And he assumes that if they're going to be followers of his, that they're going to have to be all in with him. Jesus is saying that it's virtually impossible to follow him and still follow the crowd. To be a disciple means that we venture off the pavement of the path of least resistance in life and instead embrace the climb and patience of waiting at a narrow gate for the opportunity to enter into life. This is a way of patience, too, in other words. You know, when we were coming back from Israel, we got to customs. And you're waiting in line in that long queue that goes back and forth. You're waiting to be the one who is called forward, right? It's that patience of waiting to get to that one little place. And that's what Jesus is saying to us here. We need to be patient enough to be able to wait upon God enough to know that this is the right way, the only way that leads to life. That way can be made even harder by those who try to steer you off the path. In verse 15, Jesus said this, "Beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly are ravenous wolves." Beware of those, in other words, who are eager to tell you how easy the path can be. False prophets seem to be very nice and reasonable and trustworthy because, after all, no wolf is going to let you see his claws and teeth if he can dress himself up as a harmless sheep. Right? Beware of those who only give you nice. It's so interesting. You know, we talk about this in our culture all the time, and we've mentioned it here before. But if you're going to a church and hearing preachers, or you're listening to a preacher on TV, and all they're telling you is what you want to hear, you're in the wrong place. There are too many people out there telling you, God just wants to bless you. He wants to bless you with everything. If you follow him, you'll have everything you need. Life will be spectacular. Just follow him. It's okay. There's nothing that will cost you. No. If you wish to be my disciples, pick up your cross, then come after me. That's not the message. You're in the wrong place. That may teach you to be a Christian, but it won't teach you to be a disciple. Jesus calls us to the hard road. He goes on to say in verse 16, "You will know them by their fruits, and that every good tree bears good fruit, but that the bad tree bears bad fruit." What's the fruit that Jesus is talking about here? I think the context reveals that the fruit is the character of a disciple, the kind of character that he's been outlining through the sermon. Be careful to listen to people whose lives reflect the character of a disciple, rather than those who simply talk a good game. Don't be impressed by their external marks of success, but look deeper at their character. Paul talks about this in Galatians, when he talks about the fruit of the Spirit. What's the fruit of the Spirit? Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, self-control. These are the things that matter. That's what true character is made of. I think we can take this even more broadly when it comes to talking about churches. We're having our church conference after this service this afternoon. And one of the things that we sometimes focus on as churches is our numbers. Now, those are not unimportant, but sometimes they get in our way. Whenever preachers get together, and my DS is here this morning, and she knows this because this is the kind of conversation we have all the time. When preachers get together, what's the first question they ask each other? How big is your church? How big is your church? Well, mine's bigger than yours. I have a bigger church than you. Someday yours will grow, I'm sure. There's this sort of hierarchy that says the more you have, the better it is. But you know, one of the things occurred to me a few years ago, that if you really read the Gospels closely, you notice that the more Jesus talked, the fewer people hung around. They left. So much for church growth. He was doing something else altogether. Now, it's interesting. We need to focus on numbers to some degree, but they're not everything for us. We've set goals for our coming year. We'll look at our numbers from this past year. Those are markers for us. They do tell us something. They're not unimportant, but they don't tell the whole story. What we really need to pursue as a church is deeper. What we need to cultivate is a deeper sense of what it means to be disciples of Jesus Christ. We need to cultivate Christian character and maturity in people. That's our purpose. The purpose of Charlie Chad at this church. I bet you don't have this memorized yet, but you will by the end of next year. That's another one of my goals. You came up with this, by the way. Win people to Jesus Christ. Nurture them to Christian maturity. And equip them to service in the world. That's our task. And we need to do that intentionally. We need to cultivate Christian character and maturity in people. And that doesn't happen quickly. There's no high-speed highway to discipleship. Only the long, slow, narrow path of faithful living day by day. Almost every week, Joe or I will get a call from some marketing place, some Christian marketing company, that has a program for us that will revolutionize our church. 5 happy hops to heaven, 40 days of this, 20 days of that, 3 programs, here's an ad you can put out, here's a mailer you can send, here's a flyer you can put out, or you can jazz up your website this way. And when you tell them no, they always say the same thing. Pastor, don't you want your church to grow? Don't you want to be successful? And I say to them every time, I want to say this even more clearly, that doesn't matter. There is no 5-step process. There is no 4-step process. There is only the long, slow road of discipleship. And that's a daily walk. It takes every one of us, every day, digging in hard, and then we step off the path to pick ourselves up, put our shoes back on, and be stuck in the mud, and get back on the path in the way of discipleship. As we look to 2012, then, one of the priorities that Joe and I have set as your pastors is to develop another level of discipleship building. I think this is where we need to go. And in some ways, it's an old school approach. This is not a new thing. We look back and said, you know what? We're Methodists. We have a method. It's my name. And the method is this. There's an intentional way to grow disciples. It doesn't happen by osmosis or by accident. In the early Methodist movement, it happened because people got together in small groups and they looked each other in the face and they asked the question, how is it with your soul? What are you struggling with? How is your devotional life? How's your personal relationship with God going? What sins are you dealing with? How can we help you turn from those? What are the joys that you have? What are you thankful for? That's how the early Methodist movement grew, because people realized that discipleship was happening. And it wasn't where it happened in those groups, but that's where they made sure that it was happening. The biggest part of Methodism wasn't what happened in the preaching house on Sunday, but what happened every other day during the week. To be the church is to be people who are out there being disciples all the time. Not just being Christians who sit in church. Like that old adage, you know, sitting in church doesn't make you a disciple any more than sitting in the garage makes you a car. You've got to live. So we're looking at how we can begin to inculcate this kind of culture in our own church, how we can grow these kinds of groups. I hope you're going to want to be part of that. We're going to challenge you to be part of that in the coming year. Our goal is that everyone in our church has an accountable relationship with someone where they're growing as intentionally as disciples of Jesus Christ. John Wesley said that was the key to the thing, because he once said this, I'm not afraid that the people called Methodists should ever cease to exist, but only exist as a dead sect, having the form of religion without the power. Jesus says something similar in 7:21. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. In other words, not everyone who says the right religious words or does the right religious things will experience kingdom life. We don't need more religion. We don't need more forms or processes. We don't need more programs. We don't need more doctrines and belief systems. We don't need more church conference reports. Sorry. She knows I'm talking about this all the time. But she's laughing. That's a good thing. But we don't need more of that. What we need is the power. The power that comes from following Jesus and being fully invested as his disciples. Somewhere along the line, Christianity became a lot more concerned about what people think and believe than what they do. The Sermon on the Mount calls us back to action that springs from the deep character of Christ. We can no longer only be hearers, we must be doers. We can no longer merely talk about the kingdom that is coming. We have to start living it out to the point at which, when it comes, it will no longer be a culture shock. Jesus tells us how to do that in these first three chapters of Matthew. At least three chapters of Matthew. We've been looking at over the last 11 weeks. Remember how this series started? We used a quote from E. Stanley Jones, the great Methodist missionary to India. He said this: "The greatest need of modern Christianity is the rediscovery of the Sermon on the Mount as the only practical way to live." Indeed, Jesus closes the sermon by saying that this is absolute bedrock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them will be like a wise man who built his house on rock. The rain fell and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, but it did not fall because it had been founded on rock, bedrock. People in Jesus' day would have recognized another house on the rock, and that was the temple in Jerusalem. Literally built on a rock. It was believed that the rock that the temple was built on, even from the time of Solomon, was the same rock that Abraham had taken Isaac up to sacrifice him on, not Moriah. There on that rock today, there is the Dome of the Rock, the Muslim holy place. They believed, the people of Jesus' day, that this was the rock upon which their hope was built, this temple. And Jesus comes along, and in his last great sermon in Matthew's Gospel, he warns that the temple itself would come crashing down because Israel had failed to respond to his message. But something will rise in its place. In Matthew 16, he's with his disciples, and he says to them, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter says, "I think you're the Messiah." And Jesus says, "Well said. On this rock I'll build my church. On this rock. On this Messiahship. Our rock is not built in a building. It's built on Jesus and his words that carry us forward. It's the rock upon which something very different is built. The true temple, the chief cornerstone of the kingdom. A community that embodies Jesus and not just talks about it. The Sermon on the Mount is the framework upon the foundation upon which the framework of the kingdom is built. So the more we begin to live it, the more we begin to reflect and embody the character of Jesus. And when we live this way, we are on solid ground. As the old hymn says, all other ground is sinking sand. Sinking sand. The second day I was on my own, I went to another path, and the rain had stopped, but the wind was kicking up, and I hiked to the highest point on the island, the hill called Dun-E. And Dun-E is 100 meters above sea level. Not exactly a mountain by our standards, right? But I hiked up to the top of that hill, staggering through the wind. The wind was blowing so hard, it was one of those winds where you had to really lean in to get to the top. Sort of like we had Friday, you know, it was nasty, blowing like that. And I got to the top of the hill, and I saw this cairn, a much larger cairn, that marked the top of the hill. And tradition says that this is one of the places where Columba came to pray every day. He hiked up to the top of that hill and pray. He used to pray there in the afternoon. In the morning, it was said that he waded out into the North Sea in water up to his armpits and recited all 150 Psalms every day. This man was a prayer warrior. Crazy, but a prayer warrior. Right? But I imagine climbing up to the top of this hill and feeling that wind. That day was so windy. I got to the leeward side of that cairn, and I sat up against the rocks. And it was so fascinating to hear the wind blowing around you and being in the midst of the calm. There, sheltered by that rock. And I wondered if Columba had not done the same thing and wondered about Jesus' words. Everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them, be like a wise man. He lives his life grounded on rock and sheltered from the storm. May we be guided, sheltered, and built on the rock of Jesus. May we build his kingdom as his disciples.
Amen.
Lord God, this is a powerful word for us. I know this word can rattle around in me for weeks. Help us, God, to be a church that makes disciples. May this be our number one priority. And may this be a rock of